Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Padraig Reedy. This week, East Belfast Magic Realism with John Carson's Firestarters. John Carson is a writer and community arts facilitator based in Belfast. Her first novel, Malcolm Orange Disappears, was published in 2014 to critical acclaim, followed by a short story collection, Children's Children, and a flash fiction anthology, Postcard Stories. In 2016, she won the Harper's Bazaar Short Story Competition and was shortlisted for the Sean O'Fallon Short Story Prize. The Firestarters is her second novel. John Carson, welcome to Little Atoms. We're talking about Firestarters. The Firestarters is based in present day, or roughly around East Belfast. Can you describe that setting of East Belfast?
East Belfast is it's a really interesting bit of the city. We would say it's probably the last what we call single identity part of Belfast left. So it's mostly Protestant, with gentrifications beginning to sweep in the outer edges of the East, and you'll have some young professionals buying their first houses out there. Mm-hmm. The inner East is mostly little terrace streets where the doors open onto the front street and the back door opens to the back alley. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly built to house shipyard workers. So, it's a very post-industrial area. There would be quite high unemployment rates now, and traditionally quite a stronghold for the paramilitaries. Mm-hmm. The kind of loyalist paramilitaries would have really been very present in East Belfast, and you'll see that reflected in the murals everywhere on the gable ends of the walls.
Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people nowadays in East Belfast, and sort of based from East Belfast in the summer, and most people listening might have some idea of East Belfast, that means bonfires.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the bonfire culture, because it's important. It's a fundamental part of the book.
Yeah.
But tell us about that culture and bonfires in the 12th and what that means.
It's interesting. In Northern Ireland, the culture on bonfires and the 12th of July, everyone kind of knows the background to it, and this may seem a little patronising for some people, but on the 12th of July, the Protestant community in Northern Ireland celebrate the Battle of the Boyne, when William of Orange came over and supposedly defended Ireland from the North in particular from Catholicism. How much of that is based in actual history and how much is now kind of developed, who knows? Mm-hmm. So on the 12th of July, the Orange men march behind bands, and there are parades throughout Northern Ireland. On the 11th night, there are these large bonfires lit, and they kind of commemorate the bonfires which were lit by William of Orange's loyal followers to show the way to the original battlefield. Now, when I grew up in rural Northern Ireland, the bonfire was in a field, and it wasn't too high, and was actually, we would go along, have some hot dogs, bit of singing, and be home not too late. Within built up areas, and particularly East Belfast and certain areas of, up the Shankill and different places, the bonfires are very much in urban built up areas, and they've got bigger and bigger, so they're now hitting 60, 70 feet. And will be built literally yards from houses where people live. So they can be quite threatening symbols. They're quite dangerous. They sometimes tip over. And any kind of attempts to reduce the height of them have been met with, a lot of resistance.
We start with two characters that we're following here. We have Jonathan, who's a young middle-class doctor from East Belfast, but a slightly different kind of East Belfast.
Yeah, the edges of East Belfast.
Yeah. And Sammy, who's middle-aged rather, working-class man from what you call the Inner East. And they have very different experiences of Belfast. They inhabit different spheres.
Yeah. I mean, Jonathan is a character who's grown up very middle-upper-class parents. They wanted him to achieve a lot, but didn't really give him a lot of love or a lot of nurturing. And as soon as they could, they wiped their hands off him and moved out of Belfast. And he's grown up as a doctor with an inability to connect with people. So he's quite an isolated character. He really struggles to communicate with people. Sammy is a man who's grown up in the Inner East, and his early life is very much marked by involvement with the paramilitaries. But it's not really out of any particular allegiance to the cause. It's more because Sammy has a bit of a bloodlust. He really loves violence. And the turning point for Sammy is when he has his first child, Mark, and the baby's put in his hands, and he realises that actually the responsibility that comes with being a father is much more of terrifying than anything he's ever got off a gun or a bomb. And that becomes almost like a kind of like catalyst for change. So he moves his family out of the Inner East towards the suburbs. He tries to cut off all ties with the paramilitaries, middle classify himself, really. But that bloodlust never really leaves him. It's still there in him, and he knows it's there, and he's constantly struggling against it.
Let's talk about Jonathan for a while. He's a doctor. He struggles to connect. At one point, he gets involved in a very weird
one night
describe
stand.
That very strange one night stand.
So Jonathan takes a call one night when he's the doctor on call, and he gets invited out to this block of flats on the edge of East Belfast. And when he gets there, he finds this strange woman who words don't really describe her. Like, we haven't got a name for her or anything, and she seduces him. And for Jonathan, whose whole life he's been so uptight and so unemotional, it's a really overwhelming experience. And they stay in the flat for about 3 days together, and then he decides, just on a whim, he's going to move her into his house. So she moves in with him. He loses all track of time, doesn't go to work, and it transpires very quickly that she's pregnant. And the 9 months of the pregnancy go by really, really quickly. And what happens then is when the baby's born, she's left behind. So this mysterious woman disappears and leaves Jonathan with this small baby girl. And he has realised by this point that what he's actually hooked up with is a siren. So he's been seduced by a woman who, every time she opens her mouth to speak, he's completely powerless. And Sophie, which is what the baby decides to name her, Sophie, he's not sure if she's a siren or she's a human child. So he's suddenly thrust into this situation of, I have a responsibility for this baby. She's partially mine. 50% of her is human, so it may go okay. If the 50% of her that's siren comes to the front the minute that she begins to speak, we're all in big trouble. So Jonathan's part in the narrative is really exploring this idea of what responsibility a parent has over the words, the actions, the impact that their children have. And his big struggle right from the start is whether he tries to silence her in some ways or not. But he also goes on a really interesting journey. For the first time in his life, he loves someone. He has all of this rush of emotion that he hasn't really got words or any idea of how to deal with. So he's quite a fun character to write. I come from quite a conservative background. Was raised Presbyterian, and that idea of being very in control and very formal and not letting the emotions get the run off you, as we would say in Northern Ireland, is, you know, that was very much worked into to me. So there's a lot of me in Jonathan, and, you know, as his emotions begin to come to the surface and wake up, it was quite fun to write that because I know that experience myself as well.
So, as you say, Jonathan meets this woman, and this, if she is a woman, I guess, is the question that's left looming, and has this child. He has this terrible fear, as you say, of the, which I was guessing, you know, is that thing that all parents have, is just a dreadful fear of what the hell is going to happen. And Sammy similarly has a slightly less supernatural, but no less fear about.
Yeah, it, I mean, it's not it's not a supernatural experience that Sammy has, but it is an absurd, exaggerated experience. And I guess that was one of the things that drew me as a magic realist to exploring loyalist culture in the first place. This idea that the symbols of something like a 70-foot bonfire, or you know, King Billy on his white horse, or Orange men beating these enormous lambeg drums that are, you know, the size of a tractor tire. They're absurdist. They're strange. They're, you know, they're not quite magical, but neither are they entirely realist symbols.
Yeah.
So a lot of the book, I think, is playing with those lines between what is realism and what is, you know, fictive, what's magical, what's made up. So Sammy's son, Mark, for all of his attempts to protect him and to bring his family up away from the kind of influence of paramilitaries and violence, he begins to realise that his son is actually orchestrating all of the chaos that's been going on in Belfast over this very intense summer. There's a kind of rebel faction who are reacting against height restrictions on the bonfires by setting fire to buildings and anything they can get their hands on across Belfast as a kind of mark of protest. And he realises that his Mark, who's been posting YouTube videos and controlling all of this from his bedroom at the top of the house.
And Mark is sort of part of a generation, I guess, which didn't experience the capital T troubles.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Like, Mark is about 10 years younger than me. I was born in 1980, so I did get the tail end of it. And Mark is part of this kind of disenfranchised generation of, you know, loyalist young men and women in Northern Ireland who feel like, you know, post Good Friday, a lot of their symbols, their cultural identity, their idea of who they are as Protestants has been erased. So, you know, restrictions on marching, restrictions on flags, you know, the changing of the RUC to the PSNI, and, you know, all of the legislation that was brought in to make things more fair. They do feel like the compromise has all been on their side of the boat. Now, I will say that Mark is a very similar character to his father, Sammy. And he plays the card of using the symbols and the political allegiance and the politics. But really, for him, it's the same lust for violence. Like, I don't think it would really matter which particular campaign he was pinning his card to. He just wants to cause chaos and hurt people. And even as a small child, there are these glimpses into him being fascinated by violent news stories and, you know, talk of serial killers and things like that. He's a bad kid.
Yeah, yeah. But he does, you know, does, you know, as you say, a lot of what he taps into, what feels like a grievance for a lot of people. And the language being used is about, you know, that he talks about. And Jonathan encounters some kids who've engaged in, as you said, the setting 30-foot walls. And they're talking about, we're losing our civil liberties.
Yeah.
That feels, that's a genuine concern for them. Yeah. It may not be true, but it's a real thing.
Yeah, and I mean, some of, like, language to me is really interesting, and this is essentially, it's a book that explores rhetoric and how rhetoric can be used to impact people and cause chaos, or, you know, can also be used for really good ends as well. And what's intriguing about it is, you know, I spend a lot of my time earwigging on people. I walk around, I listen to folks in coffee shops, I listen to the young people who are on the streets in East Belfast. And I'm not entirely sure sometimes that they understand the language that they're using. So these are phrases like, you know, you're restricting my civil liberties, and, you know, you're compromising my sense of identity. And they don't always have a fully formed idea of what that is, but it's a phrase they've heard and they've repeated. So, you know, I've spent years working in community projects in Belfast, and I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but you'll sometimes go into a single identity area and say, so what's the issue here? We hate Catholics. Why do you hate Catholics? Because we do. Like, have you always hated Catholics? Aye, my daddy told me to hate Catholics. And it's a repeated phrase that has lost its meaning. There's not been thought behind it. So language to me is really interesting. And the ambivalence of language, in particularly in Northern Irish culture, like the novel begins with a section on, you know, what do words mean in Belfast? You know, even what is Belfast?
Yeah.
It, you know, This is a city like Belfast. You know, it could be Belfast or it might not be. Depends what way you're looking at it.
But I think what you described about the how you can very quickly things become absurd, and the way you describe them in the book about, you know, the way the Titanic Centre looms over Belfast and the cranes loom over Belfast. There's a very weird scale thing, but also I think the with bonfires, obviously the key issue being scale. And I think sometimes you can see pictures of bonfires, you know, in the middle of, you know, terraced houses, and it looks like a trick of scale, and then you think, no,
absolutely,
this is real.
The idea for the book began as a kind of smaller piece, and I was in Washington DC and I had read a magic realist short story that I have about fat ladies being sedated and strapped to tables and shook until they lose weight, which is real absurdist and magic realism. And then afterwards I read a section of a story about these 80-foot bonfires, which was, there was nothing in it that wasn't just pure realism. And the Americans said, oh, that's great, where did you get the idea for that, you're a fantastic magic realist. And I said, you know, well, if you go up the Newton Arch Road in the around July, like, you'll see this isn't magic realism. And then they began to ask, like, do you strap your fat people to tables and shake them too in Belfast? And that was where the kind of penny dropped for me around, like, there's something to be done here with these absurdist concepts. And I guess as well, like, Kurt Vonnegut would be a big influence on my writing. And I thought a lot about Slaughterhouse-Five when I was writing this book. And just, you know, the bombing of Dresden was so real and so horrific, but also absurdist in its scale. And fire is just a really, it's such a powerful symbol.
Yeah, fire and, you know, literally melting streets.
Bubbling tarmac and windows popping out and satellite dishes that kind of go limp after a while in the heat.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I think a lot of fire stories is just about words and the absurdity of, you know, the words that people use without having any clue of their meaning. But it's also about secrets, and in particular about how societies keep secrets.
Yeah.
And how individuals, how men in particular, I guess, keep secrets.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really think about it till afterwards, because I think a lot of writers, they make things up and they say they thought for ages about their work and these were the themes they were exploring. Mostly I find you write it and then the book tells you what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we've had a real problem with depression and suicide in Belfast and over the last number of years, particularly around young men.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that is the legacy of the Troubles and the kind of psychological impact of that. And there are other factors as well. You know, we're a post-industrial city with almost no skilled labour positions. And that, I think, does something to particularly men's dignity. You know, at the height, the shipyards had 30,000 skilled labourers working on it. And now we have the cranes looming over the city, reminding us of what used to be there, but it's not there anymore. And I guess I got really interested in, there was a campaign a wee while ago about just trying to get men to talk to each other. You know, if your head's gone, you need to tell people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, you can get help and feel better about your situation. But we are a kind of community of particularly men who don't talk, and they certainly don't talk about emotions and feelings. And I wanted to explore that. You know, if you go into any pub in Belfast, you'll hear lots of talk about the football, lots of talk about, you know, politics, all the surface issues, but rarely will you hear somebody saying, like, I'm not feeling great in myself at the minute.
Mm.
And I wanted to explore that, and I think it's not a theme that's kind of particular to Northern Ireland. I'm a massive Inspector Morse fan, and you know, that is the kind of line that goes through Morse and Lewis, and now we've got Endeavour. They're men who essentially love each other in a familial kind of community way, but they would never say that.
Yeah.
There's silence and there's secrecy and there's keeping yourself to yourself.
I think you described it very well at the start of the book, the means by which men manufacture closeness, the book is based in a World Cup year.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's, you know, not necessarily a substitute for talking, but that kind of being in the pub, drinking, watching the football, talking about the football, everything, like creating at least a togetherness.
Yeah.
Bond, not quite unspoken bond, because everyone's here because they like the football, and but they're not going to get into anything deeper than that.
No.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a language that you can decode as well. Like, there are words that are used and spoken between men that mean way, way more. So even the intonation in a word can infer like closeness and or so. There's a section that I really love about the, it's not even really a word, but a lot of people in Belfast are very fond of the word yo.
Mm.
And it can be used to kind of mock someone. It can be used also to kind of champion someone and say, like, you know, somebody got an award, their mates might go, yo. It's the flexibility of language. And I think, you know, we need to learn how to decode that better, because I think there are people who are reaching out to each other, we're just not understanding the subtleties of the ways that they're communicating.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely useless and I've never used it for anything, but my master's dissertation, I did a dissertation on theology and contemporary culture, and I looked at the use of elusive rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a passage in Mark 4 verses 10 to 12 where Jesus is asked why he speaks in parables, and he says that they may be ever hearing but never understanding. And I unpicked that in Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, which is the first record where he moves from the very upfront kind of, you know, protest music that's basically telling people how to think, to use of this elusive symbolism and metaphors piled up on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really fascinated by the flexibility of, you know, if you can use words and not be prescriptive, so you're not preaching at someone or telling them how to think, but there's a flexibility of interpretation there.
Yeah.
What you're doing is saying, I think you're intelligent enough to work this out for yourself. I think you deserve to have your own opinion about how this should be interpreted. I think that you need to invest something in the interpretation of this language. It's harder work to unpick and decode language than it is to actually just be told how to think.
Yeah.
And I guess that was probably also ricocheting about in my head as well. And that's where, for me, as an arts facilitator as well as a writer, art has played a massive role in the process of, you know, being, if you want to say, post-conflict or however you talk about the period over the last 20 years in Northern Ireland. It creates this space that isn't prescriptive, where you have to invest in thinking for yourself and using language that doesn't feel like you're being told how to think. You can have a multiplicity of different identities. That's not in this book. These two characters are still in, you know, they're still in the what side are you on, you know, you're being told how to think. It's very, and that's why I think they're frustrated.
But you see a lot, I mean, Jonathan particularly, because I suppose the less socialised of the two in a way, or you, he gets very angry about cliche. He finds it very. Is that because he hasn't almost been socialised enough to understand the value of cliche?
Well, I think,
or the shorthand that people
use. To
me,
that's like, there's a passage where he talks about these people who come into my surgery and they talk like characters out of EastEnders, and, you know, have they not got any more nuanced way of talking? And what he doesn't understand that, you know, just because they're using a phrase or a sentiment that might feel tired to him, it doesn't mean the meaning behind it is tired.
Mm.
So I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. You know, we would say if something was having a hard time in Northern Ireland, you'd say, oh, dear, love you.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be said as a really past remarkable thing that means nothing. But if it's said by somebody who cares about you with the right intonation and you're looking the person in the eye, it can mean an absolute ocean of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean about it's not that the language is tired or inflexible. It's that you have to invest in being able to, you know, read the meaning behind it.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say so quickly, so Jonathan... Yeah, he does find in the almost cliched settings of a support group. He does find some way through, but it's not. It's a support group for what's called in the book "Unfortunate Children," which did the kind of strongest magic realist elements, in the book. Just tell us about that.
So there are unfortunate children all over Belfast. We really just get to meet the unfortunate children of East Belfast, which is one of my favourite phrases that I've ever come up with. And the unfortunate children are basically children who've got some kind of power or gift that they struggle to deal with. So there's an unfortunate girl who everything she touches turns to Christmas, and she gets a job in a supermarket on the checkout, and she has to wear oven mittens because otherwise she unleashes all sorts of good cheer and festive wonderfulness every time she touches an item of food. There's a girl who I love, Ella, who is a little girl with wings, but she can't fly. And her parents are constantly pushing her out of trees and off stepladders to try and get her flying. And she actually has this gorgeous gift of being able to practice resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So she can touch things and bring them back to life. But her parents aren't interested in that. They just expect her to fly. So Jonathan... he meets Ella in his surgery as a doctor. She's broken her wrist after another failed attempt to fly. And her mother tells him about this support group for parents of, you know, these not gifted children. They're kind of like crap X-Men. You know, they've gifts that like you really wouldn't want. And Jonathan goes along and he gets... At first he feels that this will be a support structure. And then he realises that, you know, his child potentially is dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, these are just kids with unfortunate issues. But his child could potentially destroy people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's even removed from that support group setting.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to have to leave it there. But well, I'm going to ask you to read first, the opening of the book describing Belfast.
This is Belfast. This is not Belfast. Better to avoid calling anything a spade in this city. Better to avoid names and places, dates and second names. In this city, names are like points on a map or words worked in ink. They are trying too hard to pass for truth. In this city, truth is a circle from one side and a square from the other. It's possible to go blind staring at the shape of it. Even now, 16 years after the Troubles, it is much safer to stand back and say with conviction, it all looks the same to me. The Troubles are over now, They told us so in the newspapers and on the television. Here we're very great with religion. We need to believe everything for ourselves. We're all about sticking the finger in and having a good hook around. We did not believe it in the newspapers or on the television. We did not believe it in our bones. After so many years of sitting one way, our spines had set. We will take centuries to unfold. The troubles have only just begun. This is hardly true either. It depends upon who you're talking to, how they're standing, and which particular day you've chosen for the chat. Those who are ignorant of our situation can look it up on Wikipedia and find there a 3,000 word overview. Further articles can be read online and in academic journals. Alternatively, a kind of history can maybe be acquired from talking to the locals. Piecing this together will be a painstaking process, similar to forging one jigsaw puzzle from two or perhaps 20. The troubles is too less a word for all of this. It's a word for minor inconveniences, such as overdrawn bank accounts, slow punctures, a woman's time of the month. It's not a violent word. Surely we have earned ourselves a violent word, something as blunt and brittle as apartheid. Instead, we have a word like scissors, which can only be said in the plural. The troubles is, was, one monster thing. The troubles is, are, many individual evils caught up together. Other similar words include trousers and pliers. The troubles is always written with a capital T, as if it were an event, as the Battle of Hastings is an event, with a fixed beginning and end, a point on the calendar year. History will no doubt prove it is actually a verb, an action that can be done to people over and over again, like stealing. And so we draw no lines. We say this is not Belfast, but rather a city similar to Belfast, with two sides and a muck-brown river soldering one to the other. Roads, other roads, train tracks, chimneys, all those things common to a functional city are present here in limited measure. Shopping centres, schools, parks, and the unspoken possibility of green acres glimmering in the spring. Three hospitals, a zoo from which animals occasionally escape. To the east of the city, a pair of yellow cranes stride across the horizon like bow-legged gentlemen. To the west, a hill, hardly a mountain by alpine standards, trips over itself as it tumbles into the bay. Strung along the coastline there are very many buildings. They are perched like coy bathers, dipping their toes in the grainy sea. There are boats, big boats, smaller boats, and that sunken boat which holds the whole city captive from the ocean floor. There are no future boats. Instead, there are glass and gunmetal structures stapled across the skyline. These are like stairs ascending towards the tooth-white heights once occupied by God. These are office blocks and hotels for visiting strangers, Americans mostly, and people from other earnest places. We have scant respect for these people and the photographs they will take. They believe themselves brave for coming to this city, or at the very least, open-minded. We wish to say to them, "Are yous mad? Why have you come here? Didn't you know there are other proper cities just 1 hour away by budget airline? There's even Dublin." We're not supposed to say this. We've already begun to lean on their money.
John Carson, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Padraig Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.